Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Gentlemen, I present to you the beautiful clarinet playing of George Crowley. This track is from Reuben Fowler's album. This is actually composed by Reuben as well. This is Wholeness from Between Shadows. Have decent bass on your speakers and you turn it up, you will be extraordinarily lucky enough to hear me on the bass clarinet. Welcome to the Jazz Podcast. It's episode 22. Today we are speaking to George Crowley. Now, let's see if we can get Dan on the phone. Let's get straight to the news.
Yeah.
Good morning, Dan. How's it going?
Doing well, you?
Very good, indeed. So the news this week, so low budget. The Mercury Awards. I'm just Googling. them because
you've got nothing to say about them
because I've got nothing to say right now and I should have lots to say because Dinosaur has been shortlisted Laura Jazz Band.
Oh great,
indeed, it's really cool. So if I just hover over, oh my goodness, so if you just type in the Mercury Award, it's like the one. It's not like, you know, best outdoor album art, you know. It's just a big old, this is amazing. Yeah, so this year's shortlist, amongst many other bands, none of which I could tell you what the names are, because I don't really recognise the album covers. What's going on here? There's a big thing that says, see this year's shortlist. 2017 shortlist. Let's see here. There's lots of, of course, very nicely designed website. Let's just, so the Mercury Award, if you haven't heard of it, is a something that's a big music award that people have won who have then become important, you know. Who has won? Ed Sheeran, isn't he? No, he's been nominated.
He's nominated this year.
Oh, man, so they're up against some big stuff. Well, let's hope Dinosaur can bring Ed down a peg or two.
Yep.
Okay, so that's the news. That might be the worst news segment ever, but there you go. What was the other thing? Oh, man, the Mums Network. Have you seen what's been going down on Facebook?
Oh, I saw a few comments from mums.
Yeah. So after the Manchester show, Helen Arkaleo got involved and started, you know, writing on Facebook how nice it is to hear us talking about Josh and his homeschooling, Josh Arkaleo's homeschooling heritage. And then, of course, my mum got involved and started, oh, another jazz mum. And then I realised, you know, that It's kind of, there's like a mum's secret network going on. So if there are any other jazz mums listening to this, you've got to let us know. We need figures and numbers.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's quite
interesting. Whose other mums are going to get involved then?
Possibly, I feel like Kat Berry, the mother of Dan and wife of Steve Berry from one of our earlier shows. There's a high chance she maybe will be involved. I'd love to have Dan on, the first son of also a musician. And Jess Berry, Steve's daughter as well. Be really cool.
Yeah, that'd be good. Do a family show.
Exactly. As I alluded to on that episode with Steve, I'm sure they've had a band called A Bunch of Berries. so maybe some kind of performance situation.
There you go.
Let's play George's show.
Let's do it.
Aha!
Aha! Hello, hello, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you.
Sweet. Yeah. Sweet. What's going on?
Not a lot today, really. Taking care of some stuff. I'm trying to get back into hustling a little bit, trying to get some gigs in for next year for a thing.
Oh, nice.
And, yeah, so just kind of a quiet day at home, really. It's the summer, so I'm not really up to very much, like a lot of people.
Yeah.
I suspect. I'm kind of out at the weekends a bit, a few gigs here or there, but, yeah, I've got a bit of time to myself. It's quite nice.
That's really cool. Well, welcome to the Summer of the Jazz podcast.
Well, quite, yeah.
Yes. Exactly. I have nothing to do, so we're doing a show every week.
Fantastic.
Churning them out.
Kicking them out, yeah. What's happened to Dan? Does he have things to do?
Yeah, I've just kind of logistically trying to do an interview with three people at once is so difficult to find a time.
Yeah, yeah, so, fair enough.
So what I will do, though, as a peace offering, I'm glad you mentioned it, is I will text him, and then if he's free, he can just jump in and say hello.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, perfect.
The wonders of modern technology, eh?
Indeed. Well, I'm not sure if on FaceTime it lets you do a three-way call, which is unbelievable, because on Skype you can.
Sure, right.
Interviewing George, if you want to say hello. There we go. Perfect.
Nice. Right.
Yeah, yeah, that was classy. Simple, but, you know, to the point. Let's talk about jazz.
Okay.
So tell me, basically we're going to spend the next 45 minutes learning everything there is to know about you, George.
Fair enough.
Yep.
You've come to the right person.
Yeah. I thought you would be a good start for your own show.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, where it is that you grew up.
I grew up in Norwich, mainly. I was born in Cambridge, and then when my little sister was born, when I was around five, we moved to Norwich.
Oh,
so, yeah, cool. I spent the intervening years there before I left home at uni age, yeah.
And then...
yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was just immediately... Norwich is one of those buzzwords for all the people that are from Norwich.
Sure.
You know.
It comes up a lot, yeah. There's some... We sort of totted it up once or tried to, and I think possibly Derby has the edge.
Oh, that's
in terms or that kind of area, anyway. But yeah, there's loads of people when I was growing up, and the generation above me as well. People like Dave Smith and Sam Crockett. So yeah, it was quite a fertile little period, or just basically, I suppose, good youth music education.
Yeah.
So I mean, good people as well. Of course.
Is that the deal that everywhere with good, like, because there is pockets, like you just said, like,
well,
Derby.
I don't know about Derby so specifically, but definitely if you look at quite a few of the Norwich names,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Julian Seagull was actually in Norwich for a bit when he was at UEA, I think, but like the young ones who grew up there, like Dave Smith, Crockett, myself, Kit, Freddie Gavita, there's others as well. All of those people went through a student big band, the same student big band, the Norwich Students Jazz Orchestra.
Yeah.
And I think that was a very formative influence, a huge influence on a lot of people. Got us all playing together as well. Because I think when your kids, when kids are learning music, it can be great for them to play and get really good at their instrument. But if they're not actually making music with other people, other kids or whoever, then it's sort of, you're missing out on half the fun.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
Totally. I feel like that's how we ended up on jazz courses, when you realised that the fun of playing with other people far outweighed the fun of individual practice.
Yeah, sure. Well, definitely that's one of the funnest parts of that kind of time around college, if you're lucky enough to have, I think, mates who are into the same things, the same sort of things, there can be a kind of group discovery, you know, when you're trying out stuff that you can't really do and having these informal plays and stuff where it doesn't really matter if anyone can't make it, you know, or like,
yeah,
make the music. I mean, you know, you're actually risking a few things and it's a friendly environment. That was what attracted me about college, I think.
Yeah.
Just having lots of people in the same place.
So is there anything notable we should all know about, like, wait, I know, I just thought of what it is that I was thinking of asking you. How did you first, like, find the saxophone and get into it?
I was thinking about this a minute ago, actually, because I knew that this might come up in this conversation, and I can't really remember. I've got a feeling it would have been through some sort of jazzy element in maybe a show that my parents took me to, because they took us to the theatre quite a lot, so I'm not sure if it was like a kind of... Maybe I saw like something in Five Guys Named Mo or something like that. That seems kind of plausible. But I don't really, there isn't really a specific moment I can pinpoint with the sax. And in the end, it didn't really matter because I was too small to hold one anyway. So it was a clarinet for me for the next sort of 2 to 3 years.
I wanted to talk about this as well because actually, we interviewed Brigitte Baraja a couple of days ago and we were talking about Ruben Fowler's album.
Between Shadows, of course.
Oh, man, yeah. And you take an absolutely a mind-numbing clarinet solo, but the good kind of mind-numbing.
I hope so, yeah.
If that's not really a phrase, is it? Good mind. Kind of... It's ridiculous.
Maybe you meant mind-blowing, but then I don't know if I
yes. can really. No, you can. I'll play a bit of it. Ruben's album can have the first ever distinction of being played probably twice in back-to-back weeks.
Amazing.
But yeah, that I always wondered how you got so good at the clarinet, because a lot of improvising saxophone players don't improvise fluently on the clarinet, but you really do.
Thank you.
You know, and yeah, across the whole register, there's no giveaway of like, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, but the Nadim Tamori only plays in the top octave when he plays on the clarinet.
Well, pretty much I do as well, but I think...
I've never noticed that.
Yeah. I think probably I was a little bit aware of that, because that is kind of one of the most common things, because then you can kind of pretend it's a saxophone for a little bit, for at least an interval of a seventh or something.
Yeah,
I guess there's a certain fluency with it, just because I did play it a lot. And even after I started playing tenor, after a brief attritional stint on the alto, I guess I played it to a fairly high level, because I was at junior academy when I did my sixth form. For those 2 years, I did classical clarinet predominantly there,
Right. Though
I had second study jazz lessons. So I guess I got to a certain point with it where I guess I'm getting to that point with an instrument, I suppose, where you can look at things and tackle them. There's not something gets put in front of you. You can kind of do your best to approach it, I guess. But certainly I remember for that one, I mean, the clarinet kind of gathers dust for me for quite a while, and then something will come along which needs it, and I have to sort of get back into shape quite quickly.
Yeah.
Although it's one, I invariably play it a little bit every week because of teaching and stuff.
Yeah.
I still teach it a little bit. But yeah, it's a funny one. It can be quite unforgiving, and you really have to just remember it's not a saxophone, which sounds like the most stupid and obvious thing, but that was really what kind of opened it up for me. I don't really... It's quite nice to be freed from some of your grips on the saxophone in a way.
Yeah.
At the same time, you have to find something else to do.
I completely agree with you. That's like when Jack Davies started his Flea Circus projects. And those are the first gigs I ever did only on the clarinet away from the saxophone. And I felt like I found a whole new character, because I couldn't play the stuff that I would normally play. My fingers just couldn't, you know, my brain, you know, like you say. And then...
Well, I'm not very good at imposing limitations on myself, you know, unless I'm practicing or something. People talk about how limitations are really useful. But I think when it comes to the clarinet, that's quite a handy thing in a way, just not being able to do what you would normally do. And kind of, it's a difficult thing. It depends a lot on the ensemble, because I don't really like trying to shout on the clarinet over lots of stuff, or less so the bass clarinet even.
Yeah.
But it can be lovely. I depped on your... Misery Tube, actually, in Jack Davies' Flea Circus at the the nudist jazz and real ale.
I can't remember why I missed that, but
it was a really good one. You shouldn't have missed it.
I know. I was just going to say that. I know already.
It was a beautiful sunny day.
That's a wonderful gig. That, what is it called? The Jazz and Real Ale Festival.
I think it's the Naturists, not Nudists.
Naturists.
The Naturists Jazz and the Jazz and Real Ale Festival happens in a sort of campsite or something.
Yeah, in Kent. It's run by Jerry Turner.
That's correct.
I say all these things because if anyone's listening, it is actually one of the nicest gigs I've ever done.
It's really friendly.
The years I've been down there, it's well worth. Whether you want to, and it's the clothing is optional. You know, you don't have to.
Yeah, apart from the swimming pool, if memory serves.
Oh, but, wow. I don't think I saw the pool.
Well, I didn't go in it, but I knew that that was the case because it was a very hot day and I did my research. I thought if I've got time, I might just, so depending on how populated it is. But in the end, there wasn't a sufficient window of opportunity.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's a decent example, isn't it, of a band that's quite well suited to the big shouting tube, you know, because you don't have to push too hard. The instrumentation's quite forgiving.
Yeah, Jack hadn't written any drums into the band, just an accordion and double bass. Yeah. So you're right. But then on Ruben's thing, which I will have played by now, so everyone's going to totally understand what we're talking about.
You can hear me play the same D alt lick so many times.
Well, it's a hard
sometimes
one.
Sometimes it doesn't go to G minor, though. Sometimes it goes to B flat.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I found that really difficult, but it was always like, you just got to do what you can do, wasn't it? I was doing a clarinet solo before Stan took a soprano solo. So, you know, someone's going to get some satisfaction in that track, whatever happens, and they might just have to wait for it. Yeah. I think I had a couple of good goes, and I was really... We did that at Angel, which is obviously beautiful facilities and stuff, and I was a tiny bit of a diva and asked to go in the booth instead of in the section. I think that helped quite a lot, because if I'd have had you guys farting around next to me, it would have been really...
Oh, it's horrible,
a lot more
it?
Difficult.
Yeah. I remember I was playing some flute on that, and I couldn't hear it at all. I was blowing.
It's quite tricky, and when there's clustery stuff, I remember actually thinking of the tune that Bridgie did on that, actually, like, we took a while on some voicings, and it was like just before lunch, and everyone was getting a bit knackered. It was like everything was slightly pitchy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was an amazing room, and amazing. I've never been there before or since, so that felt like, you know, a couple of days, I think it was January, wasn't it? So it's like no one's busy anyway. And just getting up and going into one of the nicest studios in London for 2 days of good music. It's like, yes, feels like I'm a musician, not a teacher at that point.
That was,
I remember that being really, really, really a trip, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah.
So the shows, then the clarinet. So what happened with the alto sax? You just never felt
love. Well, basically, when I'd ended up at the same school as Freddie and Kit, and Freddie was already involved in the Norwich Students Jazz Orchestra and basically asked that I come. We said you should come along. So
Freddie Gavita and Kit Downs, Freddie just Gavita and in Kit case Downs, anyone's really confused. Yeah.
So, I went down there and sort of tried out and I got the nod, which was really nice. I think the band leader, Dave Amos, liked the fact that I played loud. So if I played something wrong, he could fix it very easily. Or, he knew where it was, the problem. But he was up for giving me a shot. So he said, why don't you play tenor and try doing the chair with the solos? Because, you know, first tenor gets a lot of the jazz solos.
Sweet, yeah.
Traditional
that's
big band
place to be.
Arrangement. So yeah, that was what happened. And then I borrowed this music service tenor for a while. Far too long, actually. I didn't return it on holidays and they had the police out and everything. But I got into that more, I think, than the alto. That I had a kind of, it felt a bit earthier or something.
Yeah.
So then when I got my own tenor, that was it. That was me. I was a tenor player. The alto, I still have somewhere, but I don't think it's of very much use. I'd quite like to have one, but it's not top of my list of priorities.
Yeah.
I really like Sam Alto. I was listening to Jackie McLean this week. There was a thing that came up of him and a drummer called Michael Carvin did a duo record called Antiquity in the mid-70s, and it's like a Mardi Gras Indian chant or something, just sax and drums, and it's so groovy, and he sounds amazing on it. And that's like really, really raucous alto. I'm quite into that, actually.
Cool.
I find myself more drawn towards that now than the prettier side of it, I think.
Right.
So if I had an alto, I'd like to play really, really loud, basically.
Because Cannonball Adderley has always been the one for me.
Right,
and
yeah.
Because that's quite raucous and quite like a nice big tone, you know?
Beautiful, yeah, and bluesy, and the articulation's incredible. His time feel is amazing. Yeah, I mean, he's one of the guys, isn't he? I think that would, if I had been an alto player, he would have been a very difficult one to avoid.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's absolutely no reason why I would have or should have either, you know?
Yeah.
Wicked. But at the moment, I'm quite into the very dysfunctional alto. Not that McLean is really, but I always like it quite ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. So where did you do your undergrad degree?
I went to Cambridge for 3 years. Oh,
cool.
English literature. Yeah.
No way. I never knew that.
Did you not?
No, because Sarah Tandy did English.
She did, yeah. I don't think our paths quite crossed there.
Right.
We did a gig together the year after I left, I got a gig to do the May Ball at my old college, and it just so happened that we played on that together.
Wow, that's awesome, because Sarah was the only jazz musician until just this second that I knew that had an English degree. So she's been working, I've been like consulting with her on the Richard Turner film.
Oh, lovely.
Whenever I need any information about grammatical correctness, but now I have two.
Yeah, sure. Hit me up, man.
If you don't mind me texting, George.
That's fine.
My God.
My standards have lowered in terms of my own expression, but definitely if it's written down, I can put a fine tooth comb over that.
That's awesome.
I think there's also another, though, isn't there? Alex Hitchcock, great young tenor player.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
He, I've got a feeling, was English, too. He definitely was at Cambridge, but
I've
got a feeling he's another one to do English.
Week.
I see.
He might be right, yeah. Cause we
And yeah, I bumped into him in North Sea a couple of weeks ago, actually. He was playing with...
He's everywhere.
...one of the brass bands. There's so many brass bands. Are they Badass Brass? I think they might be Badass Brass. And yeah, lovely dude. But yeah, I thought he was a music undergrad, but apparently he did English as well. So he's one of the other weirdos.
Wow, I feel bad now, because we've only just had this conversation and I can't remember anything he said, so...
Magdalen, Cambridge, English. That was what were we talking about? That was where we'd gotten to, wasn't it?
Yeah. What made you choose to do English then?
The fact that I got into Cambridge, to be honest. I think if I hadn't have, I probably would have maybe looked elsewhere. But at school, I always really loved reading and thinking about the things that were presented to me like that. And I was quite good at writing. So they were kind of my twin big hitters, getting into sixth form and stuff. And so I went... I interviewed at Cambridge, which would have been like when December in my upper sixth year. Mm-hmm. And so by New Year, I knew I had an offer for that. And so that was what I was working to, really. I think me and my mum had agreed that had I not made the grades for that, I would have taken the year out and shedded and tried to go for one of the colleges the next year. Because I spent, like, after I finished school, I spent that summer kind of knocking around doing little random gigs with Freddie and Kit and people, and we'd like put on little jam sessions in Norwich and stuff. And I was kind of feeling, I felt probably because I was hanging out and drinking and playing the saxophone, I thought maybe this is the life for me.
Yeah.
But I got the grades, so I went and did it.
Wow. What A-levels did you do? I'm going to get really detailed now.
What did I do? I did English, French and music.
Nice.
And a history AS level.
Mm.
Yeah, that was my lot.
Lovely. Do you do a specific area of history at A-level, or is it still a general deal?
Do you know what? I really can't remember. I've got a feeling that depends on your examining board. I don't know.
Okay.
There's some pretty... I can't remember what we did. Cold War or something. It's pretty big.
That sounds amazing. I never did history, but if I did it now, I would love to do the Cold War.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't that, actually, because I don't think about it. I know very little, relatively. My brother and my little sister both did history at uni.
Wow.
So they're kind of... They went full throttle with it.
Sick.
But yeah, not me. I didn't... I think I probably should have done A2 level as it was then. I don't know what's going on now.
There's no more AS levels. It's over. Okay. You just do 2 years of study and then one massive exam at the end.
That's back to how it was. See, that was, maybe arguably they made it too easy, but I remember seeing people older than me who really felt the pressure of that, especially a subject like history. 2 years, maybe five or six massive areas, and that's all an end-loaded thing. That's quite heavy.
It's horrible, isn't it? It was easy for us. I had a great time doing it, like, every 3 months, just do it, like, nibble away at it, and know what marks you were getting along the way. So you could go back and retake modules as you went, so you didn't, like, have to... You know, I've met a few students recently who've had to take an extra year before uni, because you wouldn't know whether you were on track or not until you got your whole mark in one go.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very different kettle of fish. I think when I was doing my second year, I knew I had to get Cs.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Which was terrible in the end, because it just meant I was incredibly lazy. But
but you pulled through.
Yeah. I don't think either situations are probably ideal. Yep. That was good. That was nice. That was a good 3 years.
But then you still were up for the jazz afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I was just kind of lazy and enjoying myself, and I had some nice pals down there, and I did really enjoy some of the things I studied. But my line was a little bit like, oh, I'm going to become a musician after this, which I think was a little bit my way of protecting myself by not really applying myself that hard to the subjects I was doing. I think maybe just kind of saying, oh, well, that's great and everything. Because there were some really fearsomely intelligent and very lovely people around me. Mm-hmm. And I got on really well with all of them and stuff. But I never really threw myself in. I think I was a little bit scared by the level of some people. But I was playing and doing stuff while I was down there. I directed a big band for a couple of years. And there was a weekly Wednesday night gig at this cocktail bar in Rose Crescent in the centre of Cambridge called La Raza, which was usually Jim Hart on drums, Johnny Briley on bass, John Turville on Rhodes, and Robin Finker on tenor sax. So I found out about that really early on, and I used to just go and hang out with those guys and maybe play a tune. And then if the odd gig came up with any money attached to it, I could ask, a couple of those guys. Jim and Johnny came down and played for me when I was 18 or 19 or something. It was amazing. And
wow, that's
and
really
Kit
great.
Used to come down for the odd gig, and Josh Blackmore and people I already knew through Academy and stuff.
Yeah.
So I sort of, and the beauty of Cambridge as well, in a sense, was that I was still, 45 minutes away from London.
Yeah.
So I used to go up and hang out and kind of go to the odd gig and things like that. Especially, when Kit started at Academy, we were hanging out quite a lot, and I used to come up and visit him occasionally, and he used to come down to this La Raza night in Cambridge sometimes and sleep on my floor when I was in my first year, because he was still at school, because he'd had to restart some subjects when he moved to schools.
Right.
He'd sort of repeated a year. So yeah, like, kind of the connections were slowly forging, and I was getting an idea for how it all worked and stuff, and definitely getting exposed to some really great players, mainly through proximity to London, but there were some really lovely people in Cambridge as well. So I kind of knew that was what I was heading towards, I think, really.
Yeah.
And the terrible fact of it is that the time I wasted not doing my English degree, I could have done loads and loads of practice. But c'est la vie. I scraped a 2-1 and came out of that smiling. And then I had a place at the academy for a postgrad. So
did you audition anywhere else?
I didn't, in fact. I'd been to the Guildhall for an open day. And, you know, I knew people there as well. And that was a cool vibe. And that was a very popular postgrad for doing the kind of 1 year intensive thing.
Yeah.
But I knew academy was probably my favorite choice because of friends there and people I'd met. And I think for Trinity and Guildhall at that point, you could apply in April. And by then I'd already knew about my academy results. So that kind of, that was okay. You know, and I would have, I mean, I didn't actually visit Trinity at that point, but everyone was, you know, saying it was nice and stuff. It would have been on my list. I think I'd have done it. I'd have gone to any of them to come up and get stuck in, you know.
Yeah.
But the academy turned out to be great as in its, you know, as I'm sure they each would, but I had a very positive experience there personally.
What about it particularly, you know, was appealing and enjoyable?
Well, I don't know. I think as a postgrad, you get to dip in and out of stuff a bit more.
It's kind of like having a freedom pass, isn't it? You just go
everywhere. It is a little bit. Yeah, it's brilliant. You can go to, like, I wouldn't really sit like a whole term's class of like Tom Corley's transcription and oral, for instance, but I just drop into the odd one and they're always really beneficial. And, you know, it would mainly be hanging out with James Madden and George Hogg and kind of being a bit silly probably. But I had really nice projects from when I started, you know, and quite quickly had to kind of scrabble some teaching together, and they were really cool about what I could, you know, the fact that I had to you know, being my second year, I was already teaching at 2 or 3 schools, I think, just to kind of get together. So that was cool that they were flexible about that. And I think the kind of jewel in the crown there is probably in terms of regular staff, like the Pete's composition arranging and Barrack's World Rhythms are really like elemental classes that I definitely got a great deal from.
I have to keep saying surnames. Pete Churchill, Barrack Schmuel.
Oh yeah, I beg your pardon. I should be more formal.
Yeah, just in case no one's got a clue what's going on.
Because World Rhythms with Barrack Schmuel was on a Friday morning, and the Charlie Wright's Jam, as it was back then, was always a late night Thursday. I didn't used to make them with great regularity, to my shame. And then it was the job of Nick Smart, who was then course administrator, to tell me that if I missed any more, I wouldn't be able to graduate. And then I started going, and I started getting loads and loads and loads from that class. You know,
yes,
it wasn't like an arrogant kind of "I don't need this thing." It was usually just waking up a bit too late, or kind of, you know, going to bed a bit too late. More accurately, I suppose you'd say, back in the days when like Charlie's was maybe up to 2 gigs and then a jam, and it used to go until like 3 or 4 sometimes.
Wow.
But then, you know, actually, in my second year at Academy, Dave Hamlet and James Opstad were both with the house rhythm section there, and they were always in World Rhythms. So that's you know, even more shame to me, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had a really happy time there. I felt like I got what I wanted from it, you know. In a sense, I think, looking back, there's some of those classes I could have taken a great deal more from, actually. But I kind of was into other things at that time, or I've got quite a tunnel vision kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so whatever I was really checking out at that point or really obsessed by maybe didn't quite fit in. But I still, you know, took away a lot of really valuable stuff. And I still have notes somewhere that I can return to if I ever need to do some sort of more formal arranging.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even when I've... Back in days when I was teaching more, even just writing little arrangements for my kids that I was doing a saxophone group with that were actually fun for them to play and I could bear hearing.
Yeah.
You know, that's all like, I mean, that's by far from the pinnacle of what you get from that course, but it set me up pretty well, I think. Yeah.
I've done that a few times with school groups. I've taken my Pete Churchill notes, and I did In the Bleak Midwinter, which Nicky Isles has done beautifully. And I was like, right, watch this, Nicky, you know, and spent months on this thing. Like, it was my masterpiece. And of course, when I was finished, all the kids were just like, whoa, what's the C sharp? What's this note? And I was just, it was horrible. Yeah. And then we tried to play it a few times. It did not go well.
Wow. Yeah, you have to be kind of measured, I guess. It's more about sticking in the odd little Easter egg for you, I think.
That's the keeping one. It. You yeah, are much nice, smarter man
cheeky
than I.
Cheeky little sub.
Yeah.
I think I had them playing Countdown once, but like as a really slow chorale, which I thought was... They didn't really appreciate the significance of that, but it's like, you're playing Countdown. It's Coltrane. It's amazing. But yeah,
that's amazing. Right. George, it's no surprise that you're smarter than me, but that's a good example of it. And who was teaching you saxophone then?
I had a host of people. Well, throughout the... I started off with Martin Speak and Ian Bellamy.
Mm-hmm.
And then in my second year, I also had lessons from Stan Saltzman and James Alsop.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was a really nice spread, actually. I should have maybe had one more in there, but I'd kind of asked for James because I really wanted to go and sort of spend time with him. And also the Alexander thing. At that point, he was training to be a qualified Alexander instructor, which he now is. And so we had quite a lot of, you know, he'd seen me play and I'd seen him play and been blown away by his music and kind of his playing, you know, his whole approach.
Yeah.
So that was around the time that he was working with Golden Age of Steam fairly newly. I saw Fraud when I moved to London, which was absolutely incredible, but he more or less stopped doing that then. And so we kind of managed to swing it that he got given some hours and we were going to sort out my like big puffy Brecker neck and get my sound a bit more. Well, I don't know, actually, we didn't decide to do that in the end.
I like that, the puffy Brecker neck.
I used to really blow up. I still do a little bit, but there used to be a real kind of knot or something right at the back of my
What was throat. Making that happen?
I don't know, just a bit of tension, I think.
Wow.
Or not sufficient kind of movement with the back of the tongue or something like that. You know,
this sax player, Michael Brecker, he used to have there's loads of videos on YouTube of him playing, and he has like a collar on because he had a hernia in his neck where his windpipe pushed through the muscles.
Yeah, something bad happened, I think. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he injured himself. He burst something or... Yeah,
didn't pretty gross, didn't whatever it was.
Yeah, well, I think he was like giving it seven, you know, really taking it on like Zappa gigs or something like that. He may have been slightly the worse for wear. I don't know. He had his wild years, and I don't know if that was related. But he still used to like kind of expand his skills when I saw him when I was a kid, but didn't seem to affect his ability or fluency one bit.
No.
But for me, I think it was. So it's something that it needed to at least be checked out, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, James is really good for that. Bellamy, really good for various wonderful things. Did you have Ian when you were at college?
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it for a while, but because I had a similar thing with Stan Saltzman and... Martin Speak, lots of time with them, and like James Alsop.
Great.
I think I maybe had one or two bass clarinet lessons. James used to live right over the road from me.
Went down Tampike kind of way. Giving out people's addresses on the
I used to live in Tottenham, and he was quite close by. Yeah. And Bellamy for a few lessons, which was really cool. He serviced my tenor while I was there. That was quite nice.
He's really good at getting them really sort of tuned up. I mean, he always tells the story with me. It's very embarrassing, but like for the first couple of months he was teaching me, he just couldn't really get his head around why my tuning was so inconsistent at the top of the saxophone. In the end, we figured out by putting the neck of his horn on my horn that I'd never cleaned the neck of my saxophone.
Oh my God.
I'd had it for about 6 or 7 years. So that was pretty, I mean, that was amazing, actually. It was disgusting, and I felt very embarrassed, but then it was like having a new sax all of a sudden. And
it was that bad.
And it was also bent down. I think I used to put too much pressure.
I crimped just leaning it,
So, it was really, there was like a good film of sort of grey stuff in there, and we got it all out with a kind of a homemade pull-through, which then had to be destroyed.
A controlled explosion.
Yeah. It solved a problem, you know. But he was amazing for just like
George,
knowing
I'm
about that.
George, I'm stunned by that because I've never met a saxophone teacher who has ever said anything about cleaning them. Actually, when my students ask me, I'm like, never. You know, my tenor is from 1958, and I've never cleaned it. So,
I'd get in there at some point. Yeah,
Christ, no wonder nobody wants to book me for anything.
If it's been serviced recently, they should be. I guess they should do that. But the old ones, man, you've got it. Bellamy told me there was someone he knew in New York who'd got like a parasitic infection in the lung because of some nasty thing that was lurking in the neck. And if you think about it, it's like it's dark and a moist and often warm environment, so it's like pretty I mean, I'm not really a hypochondriac or super anal about that stuff, but it's pretty much a ideal breeding ground for all kinds of stuff, I suppose. But yeah, and also it might sort your tuning out, Rob.
My God,
George, I haven't heard you in ages, but it could be a life-changing moment. It felt like I had a brand new horn.
Wow.
It was amazing.
That's
it probably kick-started my real, you know, getting really into it at college, I reckon. It was a big moment.
Yeah. This is shocking. How do I go about this? Do I need a tiny pull-through?
Yeah, maybe. You can...
Oh my God, I'm never going to find out the answer because George has decided that he'd rather terminate the call than reveal that particular secret. Hang on, let's get him back on.
Hello.
Sorry about that. Don't know.
That's all right.
Quite what happened there. I thought you were just going to take your pull-through secret to the grave.
Oh no, did you not get that? Well, there's nothing much to say there. But
just a tiny
yeah.
pull through. Well,
yeah, get a half a J cloth and puncture it with a bit of string and then tie something heavy that will get through the end. Mm-hmm. And you should save yourself about 18 to 25 pounds.
My
although, I
goodness.
Suppose, well, that, all that stuff, you know, you buy things for all of that, but it's usually quite expensive. Although, it probably has very nice microfiber cloths.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. It's all a bit dear.
Just that's really interesting, though, because that's really never come up in conversation in any of my lessons, which goes to show, first of all, how impeccable my tuning always has been.
Sure, it's never been an issue, no. I guess.
But I actively, you know,
have encouraged or told students not to worry about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's maybe time to send out a memo.
Yeah, a big and like a health advisory at the same time.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy! So when you left academy.
Yes.
What did you do?
Well, I don't really know, to be honest. By then, so I had a little bit of teaching work. I think I had two or more schools in London, and I was just kind of, you know, the odd, you'd get functions or things that would kind of allow you to subsist. And then I guess through college, I'd sort of become interested in, or you sort of end up in bands, you know. I'd ended up in a couple of bands and we'd rehearse and do door money things, you know, nights like the Oxford or the North London Tavern. And so I was just drifting along on that tip for a while, I think.
Yeah.
I don't remember any of it with any specific clarity.
Did you run the Oxford?
Yeah. Yeah. I took that on. So probably about a year and a half after I finished the academy.
Right.
And that came about, well, like a huge part of that time when I was studying as well, which was kind of separate to college, was the fact that when I moved up to London, I was very lucky to get a room in this house in the Ridgeway in Golders Green, which was kind of a semi-famous jazz house,
mm-hmm.
which Jim Hart and Dave Smith and Robin Finker and assortment of other people, Sam Crockett, lived in. And so they were running the Loop Collective out of that place.
Right.
At that point, pretty much. I mean, there was more people in the Loop Collective, but sort of a lot of the core kind of stuff went on there. So I was exposed to quite a lot of people's original music and their kind of concepts as a collective and stuff. They were quite influenced by downtown New York stuff that had gone before, the people like Jim Black and Tim Byrne and things like that. It's a completely different side of music to what I was discovering or being, you know, having a light shone on at college and stuff. So that was that kind of DIY scene / original music scene thing had always been a presence, and that was a really valuable thing. And also living with two amazing tenor players who I really looked up to. I mean, Crockett was my second study jazz sax teacher when I was at Junior Academy. So it was quite by chance that we ended up living together 3 years later.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But yeah, where were we on before that?
We were talking about the Loop Collective and the Oxford.
Yeah, they had already reached a point where their efforts were kind of quite spread out, because the Loop Collective, I think, came out of a time when they were mainly quite fresh out of college and everyone was hanging out and people drift apart and whatever. And the Oxford had just sort of been, everyone was booking it and Sam Crockett would usually go down on a Monday night and run it and do the door and stuff. But it wasn't really, didn't have any energy behind it. So they were either going to let it go or hand it on. And so I said yes on the provision that it wasn't just me, because I'd already seen Richard Turner's work at the Con. He'd been into that for about 3 years at that point, if not more. Yeah. I didn't want to be like a pub governor, one man promoter, whatever. So I started doing it with two of my housemates at the time, Ryan Trebilcock and Josh Morrison. But then swiftly, it just kind of was easier if I did it, and kind of it just got stuff done more. So then, yeah, I ended up booking that and running that for about 6.5, 7 years, I think. Which is quite a stretch.
That's amazing. 7 years.
Yeah, yeah, getting on four. I think 6.5, maybe accurately. Yeah, but it was. I mean, it was a really. That was a really good thing for me, because I was. You know, I cared about. You know, I wanted to keep the night going, and kind of it was. It's actually an amazing gift. You realize now, to have a space and an arrangement where the pub don't really lose out, but they're not really giving you anything, so you can put whatever you want up there.
Yeah.
And as long as you can get people coming, then it's cool. And actually, I was lucky with the Oxford, because the Loop Collective did have a good reputation and a strong identity. So musicians knew about their, you know, their kind of idea.
Yeah.
Were up for coming and doing a gig for me at the Oxford, kind of keeping on that same spirit. So I could get people who I think, you know, at that point, Fiverr on a Monday night or something, it was a really, you know, people would want to go and see that. And
yeah.
Then also trying to keep a balance of younger musicians and newer bands from the student population, and making sure that there's some free improvised music, keeping a kind of spread around it. And it took a good couple of years, maybe three, maybe more, before I started getting good steady turnouts and kind of keeping it quite regular. And then certain people from the local community really warmed up to it. And by the time it finished, we had a really nice thing there, where like regularly on a Monday night you'd have 40 or 50 people up there, and a really nice atmosphere. And I kind of made the money a bit more serious a couple of years ago. So there were people who were up for coming and doing that, even though I couldn't guarantee them anything. They knew that if I had a good night, if they had a good night there, they could probably make more than they would at a place where they were doing a door split.
Right.
With a venue, you know, who have overheads and stuff. So I could say, well, I can't guarantee you anything, but if we're lucky, we'll get this. And so some people were using it as a stop off on their tour. And then it's nice because you can slot into that kind of greater landscape. I think a benefit of it as well was it was a really, really, really good sounding room. It was like really warm, wooden, live room. It was beautiful. That's the main tragedy about it going. There'll be other places like that, and there'll be other people who do the promotion thing really, really, really well. Not saying I did that, but you know, there's actually people who do it a lot better and have amazing energy out there. But it's sad to lose a space which sounds good.
What stopped it in the end?
New management.
Oh, that's the worst, George. Yeah, that just is soul destroying. Well,
that did the NLT pretty quickly, didn't it? The North London Tavern in Kilburn. That went.
Yeah, that was going really well.
And that's, so you know, that's the sister pub. They're on the same chain, those two pubs.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
And that was a worrying sign.
Yeah.
So the Oxford, the Loop Collective Oxford, actually started first at the North London Tavern.
Right.
And then they moved to the Oxford as a more central location. Possibly the manager who was there moved to the Oxford and said, why don't you come along?
Yeah.
It was really sad when that happened, because Jack and those lot had an amazing vibe on a Sunday night. Similar thing, actually, like regularly 40-odd people, you know, filling the upstairs room of a pub. What's not to like? But apparently it wasn't quite for them.
Yeah.
And I sort of started meeting a little bit of resistance, and sort of, you know, not giving me change to get the door going or something that was just so remedial. And I couldn't understand, you know, I've never done anything, even depping running other people's nights or at the Con or wherever, where that's ever been an issue. And it's like the times when you mess up and accidentally pay the band that money,
yeah,
and you just have to go to the cash point and say I'm sorry, and you give them that money, and it's like there's nothing to risk, there's nothing to lose. I felt this resistance, and I didn't react terribly well, and then it was over quite quickly.
Yeah
And it's sad, but you know, I was probably going to move on from that at the end of last year, so it went in July.
Yeah.
And I think if I'd have maybe my plan was actually to get someone younger and with a bit more time on board,
yeah,
do the autumn together, and then leave it with them if they were up for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, so just how things go. It wasn't meant to be.
No. And if the pub aren't really keen for it, you know, then it's going to be incredibly difficult. It's hard enough.
No, you don't
anyway.
Want that. Yeah, you don't want that kind of attritional situation. I think what made that frustrating is that I had worked through those before.
Yeah.
Like I had to sort of tiptoe around new management and stuff, and it had turned around. But it can be a very difficult thing for pubs or venues that rely on that kind of place, is that they seem to have a very high turnover of management.
Yeah,
who are all then, you know, and because it's a chain, often the orders coming down don't tend to reflect the situations of the individual pubs, perhaps. Like, I nearly lost it a few years before that because there was just a big drive from management saying, we've got to use that room for functions, because if someone books that room, they'll make a lot of money. But then I, you know, slowly kind of talked them down from that, because no one, you know, Monday night was never a prime party night for anyone, which kind of made it perfect at that place.
But yeah,
you like you say, it's not terribly fun to, even the few weeks where I was sort of, you know, going to the mattresses a little bit, or just, you know, aware of a hostility there, it wasn't that fun. And when it was announced that we wouldn't be continuing, you know, obviously I wrote an imploring email trying to smooth things out and whatever, but that never even got responded to. So then I knew, you know, I was actually, the tensest thing was the last couple of gigs, actually hoping that we'd turn up and they would be going.
Yeah.
Because I'd never even had an email assuring that, there never even a response from this guy once he canned it. And like, the last gig was James Mannering of Roller Trio and Django Django fame. He brought his project down with Matthew Bourne and stuff from Leeds. And if that had been jettisoned for whatever reason, I think it was a World Cup at the time as well, so I was a bit tense around that. But yeah, thankfully that was a belter of a gig, and we went out on a high.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always the con.
You're running the con cellar bar?
Not single-handedly, but yes.
You took, and so who's running it with you?
It's kind of an assortment of people now. It was after we lost Richard, it was sort of me and Tom Challenger and Sam Jessen. Do you know Sam, the drummer?
Yeah.
And Dan Nichols. Mm-hmm. And then because me and Sam and Dan were all living together in the Ridgeway, in the jazz house, we sort of ended up doing it. And then Tom definitely had his input, but because we're in the same place, he kind of sorts stuff out. And then, Lloyd and Alex Haynes more recently have been helping us book and run a lot of it as well.
Oh.
And Alice Leggett, she lends a hand all the time. So it's kind of a slightly expanding crew now. I think that was one of those ones where definitely no one was going to step in and do it single-handedly, because the legacy is just so great, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what the whole film is probably going to end up spinning around, is the legacy of the venue and the whole generation that's been created around it. You know, all these people that we're talking about now, like so many, it's all about like having these spaces, having the con, having the Oxford, making places to play, and then booking gigs and creating a scene out of pretty much nothing.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I mean, the thing with that is nothing until, there is a place or something. Because, I mean, I can't imagine, I've talked about this to people recently, actually, about kind of students and music and stuff. And, like, if you're studying jazz and working really hard and you know, doing as you're told or whatever, and you don't have a playing life outside of college, or there's no, like, practical application to what you're doing, it seems like a waste. It's like the kids we talked about before not playing together, you know. So, yeah, it was, I mean, it's absolutely enormous. And it's still, you know, to some people, they'll just walk down there and it's just a dingy cellar. And I kind of love that as well. Like, if you could persuade someone to stay and they had a seat in that main room and, you know, we put something good on, which we do, it's one of the most atmospheric and intimate and wonderful places to hear music in London.
Oh, I completely agree.
Like you say, like, so many bands and so many collaborations and so many friendships and so many things have come out of that place, and people putting bands together to do a gig at the con, which then turn into bands, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty massive, and a very, very, you know, a fitting tribute to Richard, I hope, that it's still, you know, that we still try and do that. I don't think it's anywhere like the scale or the ambition that he used to have. We don't really try and do big name stuff anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like he had Fly with Mark Turner and Jeff Ballard and Larry Grenadier and some big time stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, we don't really do that anymore, because there's loads of great stuff here and none of us are really in a position to risk. Like, we're not those kind of promoters, you know, we'll start the party, but we can't really, none of us can afford to drop a grand if something goes badly or something. So
no, because I think, like, Richard promised with that Fly gig that he would pay them himself, or that if they didn't make money on the door, he was going to pick up whatever it was that...
Yeah, you have to.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, and it's fair enough as well. These are amazing musicians who have busy schedules internationally, and if you want to keep them on for an extra night in London, they have to have, you know, you can't just say, oh, I'm really sorry, it didn't quite go to plan.
Yeah.
Or if you do, maybe you can do that once, but yeah, that's no good. And Richard had the utmost respect for those people and tremendous love and respect for that music. He did it, though, that one. That was pretty... I can't remember. I mean, Wendy definitely helped. Wendy, who up until recently was the landlady at the con, who was like the enabler for all of this, really. She was so wonderful and supportive, and she definitely helped put people up, I think, when we had to do, when he did stuff like that. But that fly gig, yeah, he nailed it. I think he made it all.
Yeah, that's incredible. That was a real... There's some pictures of that that I've got.
I've got a bootleg of that somewhere, but it's really, it's a bit muffly. It was a zoom in my duffel coat pocket, so it's kind of everything's coming through a thick layer of fabric. But I bet there's a few others. A lot of people had their devices, because before everyone bootlegged everything on their phone, people would carry around these massive Zoom H4s.
Yeah, of course.
It'd take up a whole pocket of a duffel coat. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. But the con is such a hidden gem. You know, if you want to go and see like what I would consider the real jazz scene, as opposed to like certain venues, you can go on certain nights of the week where they just need to pay rent because they're in London, you know, but the con is really an incredibly authentic and amazing
place. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think there are little gems like that, or certainly some of those nights across the week that you were mentioning, like I do those kind of gigs and I really enjoy playing, and it's not, you don't tend to find that jobbing thing anywhere that's got any kind of music reputation. And certainly the con, that's just, I mean, there is another jazz night at the con, which I think maybe weekly, it may be a weekly Wednesday, which I think is more trad jazz. But our thing is just once a month. So
yeah,
it really is. We just sort of take over the place, and it's always two bands, and it's affordably priced. It's concellarjazz.com. We'll be back in September. It's a wonderful thing to be involved with. It's still one of my favorite places to listen to music, and it's definitely among my favorite to play in.
Yeah,
although it does freak people out if they haven't done it before, because it's pretty intimate, you know.
It's so easy. Like, what, you seat like 50 people at the most?
We can't seat that many.
You can fit 50.
No, I think it's about 60 to 70. Oh, okay. if we're absolutely thronging it. But then some of those people will not have any direct sight line of the music.
Right.
But if it's a listening vibe, it can be fine. You can still hear it. And if it's a really listening atmosphere in that place, sometimes it's amazing just closing your eyes and you can still hear everything really clearly at the bar. But yeah, in the main room, if we're really packing them in, I think we can seat 40.
Wow.
So it really is dingy. I mean, dingy? No, tiny. I mean, it can be a bit dingy as well, but we try and light it appropriately. But yeah, it's a tiny thing. You know, if you get a seat in that main room, and that's why people turn up, you know, at like 8:30 every time we do the gig.
Yeah.
We open the doors and certain people just know if they turn up then they can get a seat, and then they love it, you know.
Yeah.
And then what I like is when that's happening and there's a nice focused energy in the main room, I like it when it's not just the people who turn up at 8:30, when you get some other types who manage to get a seat as well, because you want a kind of varied crowd.
Yeah.
And then you get usually musicians hanging in the bar area where they've got a good sight line of some of the things, or they can have a little chat and still appreciate the music. So there's a little buzz around that as well.
Yeah.
It's really, it's one of, I mean, obviously I'm tremendously biased, but it's one of those wonderful things for me. Yeah.
Definitely. So... Hopefully no issues with the management ever.
No, I don't think so. Wendy, the previous landlady, and her husband, Jim, were very keen that they didn't want it to just become another sort of gentrified chain pub in Camden. So they sold it on to someone who's kind of, I think, a really, I don't know what his position is, but I think he's got like 4 pubs and they're just sort of hobbies, you know.
Oh, lovely. And, that sounds perfect.
So I think they kept all the staff on and kept everything the same, basically.
Well,
and then the current manager, who's obviously not the owner, Martin, he's obviously, he's seen us pack the place, and I don't know if any of the people who work there really love the music that we do, but they all have got a lot of love for the night.
Yeah.
And of course for them it's great seeing the place full on a Friday, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're really supportive and really lovely. And we're going to have, for the first time, we're having two jazz festival events there this year.
Oh, wow.
So we're doing both Fridays. So that's like, hopefully a few more people will get a chance to come down and check out what we're programming, because I think it's going to be pretty fun.
That's sweet. So what's going on with projects, with your...
Projects?
With your life, your saxophone, anything that we should know about?
Well, I guess
there's things that we should know about.
Yeah, I'm working on a new thing at the moment, which is a trio with myself and Rob Luft on guitar and Tim Giles on drums. And we did the first one, obviously, at the con in June, and I got a couple of new pieces out, and we have a thing at the Vortex in the Jazz Festival, and we're going to be playing at the Royal Albert in New Cross on the 12th of August, I think it is, a Sunday.
Oh, cool.
And that's like a new, it came out of a pickup gig last summer where Ollie Windling at the Vortex had someone pull out on a Friday night or something, and I got Tim on it, and then all of our usual favourite bassists were gigging, because it's late notice, and so I thought, what about Rob? Because he's just an amazing virtuoso guitarist and can fill many roles, in that setup without bass. So we played and just played tunes and stuff, and it worked really well. So
that's very interesting, George, because I know you don't know this, but I have my band is bassless, and Rob Luff plays guitar in mine as well.
Does he really?
Yeah.
He's everywhere. I mean,
he is at the moment. I feel like that.
Well, he's got a record out on Friday, I think.
Is it on Friday? Cool.
Yeah, I've got a feeling it is, or maybe the launch is. No, I think the launch is in September, and it's out on Friday.
Oh, wow, because I remember seeing the launch in September, but
that's going to be monstrous, I'm sure, with amazing people. Yeah, we played like a little bit mainly in Corey Dick's band, because that's quite a large ensemble. It's like 9 to 10 people. Often if someone was missing, he'd just come in and fill in their bits, like whoever it was, whether it was bass or organ or, he was kind of a floating depth who could do everything in that. So that was kind of what got us playing together.
Yeah.
And even on that first gig with Tim last summer, I brought some pedals because I've been doing a bit of stuff with that in certain contexts so that we could do some slightly more sort of ambient washy improvs and stuff like that, and written some stuff which makes use of a few of those things, and I had a little synth on the gig at the con as well, so I could play some bass, even just drones or pedals, and kind of fatten up the sound a bit. So I'm kind of looking into kind of coming from a groove, the same sort of fun and really easy, effortless to play with you groovy, happy music we were doing on the first gig, when we were just calling like boogaloo tunes and the odd misplaced standard and stuff.
Yeah.
Trying to take that kind of vibe and that energy and then seeing what else we can do with it, with some different influences and stuff. It's early days yet, but I think it's going to be cool. We've got some gigs coming in for next year, so that's kind of what I'm working on at the moment, is trying to get us in a modest to good tour.
Yeah, that's
and
amazing.
And then maybe off the back of that, we might be into a position where we can make a recording,
Yeah.
So that's good. Yeah, that's the main focus for me personally. But then otherwise, there's been recorded recently with a new quartet of Ivo Neems, which is really exciting.
Nice.
And continuing to play with Melt Yourself Down, which is Pete Wareham's band, which is not a jazz thing, but more of a sort of clubby party band kind of thing, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which is really, really fun. It's a totally different aspect, totally different angle of music, it's big energy and going for it and not playing any jazz.
Yeah,
it's mega. It's really fun. Those are kind of the main things, or at least they have been in the last few weeks. It kind of all just spirals around and lands wherever it does. And those have been the things that have been on my plate recently,
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
Sick. Well, we can look out for that project next year. Gigs, promoting. I'll be all over it like a rash.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Oh, yes.
That's amazing, man. I might get you to plug the one in August as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That was the 12th of August, wasn't it?
I'd have to check that, but yes, I think so.
Oh, cool. Well, I think the show will be out on the 4th.
Mega.
Which will be the night of the next Concelebar, which is why I'm not talking about it, because everyone's going to be listening to this either with several hours left or the week of that show and be like, oh yeah, that's just happened.
No, I think we can call that. It's going to be, it's pretty much sold out now. So by it's going to be done.
Okay.
We're keeping that one pretty intimate and Yeah, that's going to be amazing.
Yes. So I need to talk to you about that, but we'll save it to afterwards.
Yes.
So.
Oh, it's the 13th. I beg your pardon.
Oh, the 13th of August. August. Where is 13th. This gig? Is this the one at the Prince Albert?
Royal Albert, I think.
The Royal Albert, yeah.
But it's I think that's going to be New Cross. Yeah, it's one of the good music companies or whatever it is. The guy called Tom Sankey puts on really great gigs, which I've as yet failed to go to any of. So I'm very, very chuffed that he's given us a shot.
Yeah, that's cool.
He does the Cable Cafe as well, which is Elephant and Castle or something, which I've heard is a very vibey space.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I haven't been there. That sounds good. So, George, thank you for coming on the Jazz podcast.
My pleasure, Rob. Dan asked me some questions
to ask you. Oh, really? Yeah, he did. And actually, I'm going to ask you one before I ask his. Do you have a favourite album?
Oh, it's too difficult. So probably not. I mean, I have a favourite album. Yeah, I always have a favourite album, but it changes what it is.
What is it right now? And we won't hold you to this because I accept that it may change by the end of this episode.
Well, right now it's Crescent again, actually. That's one that's usually up there in the top five.
Whose is that?
John Coltrane, Crescent.
Oh, right, yeah.
Crescent, his seminal, what is it, 64? So it's post Love Supreme, but not very far after that.
Right.
It's got a beautiful song on it called Wise One. It's got Lonnie's Lament. That's like, I think that's my favourite of the... Of the classic Coltranes. Right. Although recently, actually, because it was the 50-year anniversary of his death last week, wasn't it? And
yes.
I went, there was some very nice, it was one of the good stuff, the good sides of social media where people share
really,
really
nice.
Killing music and stuff. And that got me back listening to The Showboat 1963, which is just a bootleg, but you can find it online, I think, where Coltrane with Roy Haynes and Jimmy Garrison, because Elvin was in prison and McCoy was late. It's really, really heavy.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing, actually. That has to be checked out. Chasing the Train. Yeah, live at the Showboat. Just put that into YouTube and go on a little 12-minute journey.
Oh, lovely. Mm. One of my headphones fell out and it sounded like you'd said the croissant.
Oh, I think that's Tim Giles' name for that album, Crescent. He has alternate names for a lot of things.
Oh,
he's
well.
A funny guy, but yeah, Croissant is a nicely ludicrous title for a very heavy spiritual album.
I like that. I'm going to look up those alternative names. That can't possibly go wrong. That sounds amazing. So Dan says, ask him about magic. He used to do it. He was in the Junior Magic Circle.
I visited the Junior Magic Circle, but I was never officially in. I went along with my friends one night. I think they thought I was a bit green because I couldn't really suspend disbelief.
Yeah.
So I was never really cut out to be a clinical magician because people would show me stuff and everyone would be like, oh, that's a great effect. You did that or that or that. And I'd be like, wow, how did you do that?
it's real magic. Oh, my God.
There was a teacher at my secondary school, Mr. Fisher, who taught English, who had some good magic, and he ran a little magic club after school on a Wednesday, and I got quite into it. Yeah, a bit of close-up card magic and manipulation, a tiny bit of manipulation, although I'm talking more to Dan now. But yeah, I had Jeff McBride manipulation 1 and 2, Dan, but I couldn't do any of the big stuff. I used to do a bit of magic, but I never got to the level that Mr. Farrant is at now, of course.
Yeah.
It was a wee hobby, but I used to love going down to Davenport's, the magic shop in Charing Cross, and like looking through their vast catalogue and getting a new trinket, a new little effect or prop to try and mess up people who were slightly inebriated on a weekend. It's great. Which is, I suppose that's basically what Dan's doing now, but he's getting paid for it.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right, George, this is it.
Please.
I'm going to press
stop. Nice one, Rob.
Yeah,
thanks
it's been
so
a pleasure.
Much.
But let's actually keep talking for a second about the con next week.
Yeah, cool.
Let's pretend it's the end.
Cheers, Rob.
Sweet.
Speak to you soon.
Thanks, George.
Right. Bye-bye. Bye.
And that was George Crowley.
That was George Crowley. That was very exciting and emotional. Really fun to talk about venues and... You know, George is responsible for a lot of gigs that happen in London and giving people a place to play. So we're eternally grateful for all the effort that he's made. And I haven't actually played any of George playing the saxophone in the show, but quite a bit of him playing clarinet
Oh, nice.
Yeah, just found some really nice things. It upsets me greatly that George is just definitely better at the clarinet than me.
Most people are, Rob.
Yeah, I know. Don't worry, Dan.
Joking.
It's another intervention. Oh, God.
You're better than me.
Oh, yes. Thank you, lads. I knew that. That felt good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So next week is Brigitte Baraja. And she just has the most amazing voice. I know that sounds obvious. She's a singer. But she, her accent, I think she's Italian. And it comes across very nicely.
Nice.
Yeah, big time. So,
look forward to that one.
Yes. So,
you're recording an interview now, aren't you?
Yes. Actually, you're right. It's 9:29. Chris Montague at 9:30. This podcast is absolutely steaming all over the jazz scene at the moment. We are so busy, you can't catch a break between 9:29.
I'm driving back from Devon.
Oh, yeah. What did you think of Totnes? So, the Totnes review show. Let's go.
Oh, yeah. Right. It was good. I enjoyed it. We had some nice meals. The weather was terrible, but that was great.
Yeah. I feel for my friend who got married, Vic Barton.
He's a singer. Poor chap.
It was a washout. I mean, it was lovely. And the marquee was extremely cozy. But it was just as well that they paid money for a really nice marquee that was waterproof.
Otherwise it would have been a different story.
Yeah. What did you do in the rain?
We played games.
Nice.
Did a bit of a walk.
Monopoly deal?
We did, yeah.
Yeah, same here.
Did a couple of puzzles.
Nice. How many pieces?
We did two 500 ones and then 1,000.
Oh, lovely. I like that. Warm up some easy ones. That sounds awesome. There's some really trendy shops there. Totnes, if you're looking to go somewhere that has, you know, successfully retained its character, that's a great place to go because...
I enjoyed it.
They built a Costa a few years ago and everyone boycotted it and it shut and it's gone. So there's only...
Oh, good, cool.
Yeah, no. There's no chains on the high street.
Nice. Yeah. Anyway, you were going to talk to Chris.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That sounds nice. And I'll see you next Friday.
Ciao.
Farewell.
Bye.